Captain John Summers disembarked in Valparaiso on the day set by the Machi. It was the second Friday in the full summer of February. The bay was seething with activity, with 50 ships at anchor and others waiting their turn outside the port to come in. As always, Jeremy, Rose, and Eliza were at the dock to welcome this admirable Summers, who, as always, was loaded with trinkets, stories, and gifts. Average citizens, who had appointments to visit the ships and buy contraband, blended in with seamen, travelers, stevedores, and customs employees, while a group of prostitutes, stationed at a certain distance, was studying the lay of the land. In recent months, ever since news of gold had stirred the greed of men on every shore of the world, ships had entered and left at a crazed pace, and the brothels couldn't keep up. The most intrepid women, however, were not satisfied with the steady streams of business in Valparaiso, and had calculated how much more they could earn in California, where, if what you heard was true, there were 200 men for every woman. In the port, people jockeyed around carts, draft animals, and bundles. The air was filled with a babble of tongues, ships' horns and guards' whistles, and the smell of fish baking in great baskets in the sun, mixed with the stench of animal excrement and human sweat. Miss Rose, holding a vanilla-perfumed handkerchief to her nose, scrutinized the passengers in the dinghies, looking for her favorite brother, as Eliza sniffed the air in quick gulps, trying to separate and identify the odors. She was the first to sight Captain Summers. She was so relieved that she almost burst out crying. She had been waiting for him for several months, sure that he alone would understand the anguish of her frustrated love. She hadn't said a word about Joaquin Andieta to Miss Rose, much less Jeremy Summers, but she was sure that her seafaring uncle, whom nothing could surprise or frighten, would help her. The moment the captain stepped onto dry land, an exhilarated Eliza and Miss Rose threw themselves on him. He clasped them both in his formidable arms, lifted them off the ground, and whirled like a top to the gleeful shouts of Miss Rose and the protests of Eliza, who was about to throw up. Jeremy Summers greeted his brother with a handshake, asking himself how it was possible that his brother hadn't changed a hair in the last 20 years and was as rollicking as ever. "What's this, my little pumpkin? You look a little peaky," the captain said, examining Eliza. "I ate some green fruit, uncle," she said, dizzy and leaning against him to keep from falling. "I know you two didn't come down here to welcome me. What you want is to buy some perfumes, I'll wager. I'll tell you who has the best, straight from the heart of Paris." At that moment, a foreigner walking by bumped the captain with his suitcase, which he was carrying on his back. John Summers swung around incensed, but when he recognized the culprit, jokingly shouted one of his characteristic curses and grabbed his arm. "Come meet my family, Chino," he called cordially. Eliza stared openly at the man, because she had never seen an Asian close up, and at last she had before her a citizen of China, the fabulous country that figured in so many of her uncle's tales. This was a man of uncertain age, rather tall compared to Chileans, although beside the hearty English captain he looked like a boy. He walked without grace, had the smooth face and slender body of a youth, and an ancient expression in his obliquely set eyes. His doctoral restraint contrasted with a childlike laugh that burst from the bottom of his chest when Summers spoke to him. He was wearing trousers cut off at the shin, a loose muslin smock, a sash about his waist in which he had tucked a large knife, cloth slippers and a beat-up straw hat, and a long braid trailed down his back. He greeted them with several nodding bows without setting down his suitcase or meeting anyone's eyes. Miss Rose and Jeremy Summers, uncomfortable at the familiarity with which their brother was treating a person of obviously inferior rank, did not know what to do and responded with a brief nod. To Miss Rose's horror, Eliza held out her hand, but the man pretended not to see it. "This is Dao Chen, the worst cook I've ever had, but he knows how to cure almost any ailment. That's the only reason I didn't make him walk the plank," the captain joked. Dao Chen made a new series of little bows, laughed for no apparent reason, and then backed away. Eliza wondered if he understood English. Behind the backs of the two women, John Summers whispered to his brother that this Chinaman could sell him the best quality opium and powdered rhinoceros horn for impotence, in case one day he decided to break the bad habit of celibacy. Hiding behind her fan, Eliza listened, intrigued. That afternoon in the house at tea time, the captain handed out the gifts he had brought. English shaving soap, a set of Toledo steel scissors and Havana cigars for his brother, tortoiseshell combs and a manila shawl for Rose, and, as always, a jewel for Eliza's trousseau. This time it was a pearl necklace, which she thanked him for profusely and put in her jewel box along with the others he had given her. Thanks to Miss Rose's obstinacy and her uncle's generosity, her dowry chest was filling up with treasures. "This business of a trousseau seems a bit foolish, especially when there's no bridegroom in hand," the captain joked. "Or maybe there is one on the horizon." Eliza exchanged a terrified glance with Mama Frisia, who had just at that moment brought in the tea tray. The captain said nothing, but asked himself whether his sister Rose had noticed the changes in Eliza. So what was feminine intuition good for, anyway? They spent the rest of the evening listening to the captain's wondrous stories about California, even though he hadn't been there since the discovery of gold, and the only thing he could say about San Francisco was that it wasn't much of a town, but that it did sit on the most beautiful bay in the world. The brouhaha about gold was all that anyone was talking about in Europe and the United States, and the news had reached even the distant shores of Asia. His ship was crammed with passengers on their way to California, men of all ages and conditions, ignorant of the most elementary notion of mining. Many had never seen a fleck of gold in their lives. There was no comfortable or quick way to get to San Francisco. A sailing ship took months under the most precarious conditions, the captain explained. But traveling across the American continent, defying the immensity of the land and the Indian raids, took longer, and there was even less chance of getting there alive. Those who came by ship via Panama crossed the isthmus first in long boats along rivers roiling with predators, and then on muleback through deep jungle. When they reached the Pacific coast, they took another ship north, having endured devilish heat, poisonous reptiles, mosquitoes, and plagues of cholera and yellow fever, to say nothing of unspeakable human wickedness. Travelers who had been spared falling off cliffs on their mounts and had survived the dangers of the swamps to reach the other ocean found themselves victims of bandits who robbed them of their belongings, or mercenaries who charged a fortune to take them to San Francisco, piling them like cattle onto ships coming apart at the seams. "Is California very big?" Eliza asked, trying not to let her voice reveal her heart's anxiety.
"Bring me a map and I'll show you. It's much larger than Chile."
"And how do you get to where the gold is?"
"They say there's gold everywhere."
"But say, for example, you wanted to find someone in California."
"That would be very difficult," the captain answered,
studying Eliza's expression with curiosity. "Are you going there on your next trip, Uncle?"
"I have a tempting offer that I think I will accept. Some Chilean investors want to establish a regular cargo and passenger service to California. They need a captain for their steamship."
"Then we shall see you more often, John," Rose exclaimed. "You do not have any experience on steamships," Jeremy noted.
"Maybe not, but I know the sea better than anyone."
On the night of the appointed Friday, Eliza waited for the house to quiet down before going to the little shed in the farthest patio to meet Mama Frisia. She got out of bed and went downstairs barefoot, wearing only a cotton nightgown. She had no idea what nostrum she was going to be given, but she was sure it would be far from delightful. In her experience, all medicines were unpleasant, but her mamacitas were foul.
"Don't you worry, Nina. I'm going to give you enough liquor that when you wake up, you won't remember any pain. One thing, though," she had told her, "we will need a lot of rags to catch the blood."
Eliza had often made that same trip through the dark house to meet her lover, so she did not have to feel her way, but that night she went very slowly, dragging her feet, hoping for one of those Chilean earthquakes capable of flattening everything to give her a good excuse not to meet Mama Frisia. Her feet were icy, and a shiver ran down her back. She didn't know if it was cold, fear of what was going to happen, or the last nudge of her conscience. From her first suspicion that she was pregnant, she had heard a voice calling her. It was the voice of the baby in her womb. crying out for its right to live, she was sure. She tried not to hear it and not to think. She was trapped, and as soon as she began to show, there would be no hope or forgiveness for her. No one would be able to understand her fall. There was no way to recover her lost honor. Neither prayers nor Mama Frisia's candles could prevent her disgrace. Her lover wasn't going to turn around in mid-trip and hurry back to marry her before you could see she was pregnant. It was already too late for that. She was terrified at the thought of ending up like Joaquin's mother, branded with a shameful stigma, shunned by her family, and living in poverty and loneliness with an illegitimate child. She couldn't bear rejection. She would rather die once and for all. And she might die that very night, at the hands of the good woman who had brought her up and loved her more than anyone in this world. The family started to go to bed early, but the captain and Miss Rose stayed locked up in her little sewing room, whispering for hours. Every voyage, John Summers brought books to his sister, and as he left, carried mysterious packets that Eliza suspected contained things Miss Rose had written. She had seen her carefully wrapping up the notebooks, the ones she spent leisurely afternoons filling with cramped writing. Out of respect, or some strange reluctance, no one mentioned them, just as no one said anything about the muted watercolors she painted. Writing and painting were treated like minor aberrations, nothing to be truly ashamed of, but nothing to boast about either. Eliza's culinary skills were received with the same indifference by the Summers, who tasted the dishes in silence and changed the subject if visitors commented on them. On the other hand, they offered undeserved applause when it came to her valiant efforts at the piano, even if barely good enough to stumble along accompanying a singer. All her life, Eliza had seen Miss Rose writing and had never asked about it, just as she had never heard whether Jeremy and John themselves did. She was curious to know why her uncle was so furtive when he carried Miss Rose's notebooks away, but without anyone stating it, she knew that this was one of the fundamental secrets upon which the family's equilibrium depended, and to violate it would be to bring down with one puff the house of cards they lived in. For a long while now, Jeremy and Rose had been asleep in their rooms, and her Uncle John had gone out on horseback after his long talk with his sister. Knowing the captain's habits, the girl could imagine him carousing with some of his flighty women friends, the ones who said hello in the street when Miss Rose wasn't with them. She supposed that he danced and drank, but as she had barely heard whispers about prostitutes, the idea of anything more sordid never occurred to her. The possibility of doing for money or sport what she had done with Joaquin Andieta for love never entered her mind. According to her calculations, her uncle would not be home until early the next morning, which is why she nearly jumped out of her skin when, as she reached the ground floor, someone grabbed her arm in the dark. She felt the warmth of a large body against hers, a breath of liquor and tobacco in her face, and immediately identified her uncle. She tried to slip loose as she struggled to slap together some story about why she was there in her nightgown at that hour, but the captain marched her to the library, dimly lighted by moonbeams falling through the window. He sat her down in Jeremy's English leather armchair while he looked for matches to light the lamp. "All right, Eliza, now you're going to tell me what the hell's going on," he ordered in a tone he had never used with her. In a flash of lucidity, Eliza knew that the captain would not be her ally, as she had hoped. The tolerance he liked to boast of would not be forthcoming in this instance. If the good name of the family was in question, his loyalty would be with his brother and sister. Mute, the girl held his eyes, defying him. "Rose tells me that you've fallen in love with some fellow or other who is clearly on his uppers. Is that right?"
"I saw him twice, Uncle John, and that was months ago. I don't even know his name."
"But you haven't forgotten him, have you? First love is like smallpox. It leaves its scars. Were you alone with him?"
"No."
"I don't believe you. You think I am a fool? Anyone can see how you've changed, Eliza."
"I don't feel well, Uncle. I ate some green fruit and my stomach's upset, that's all. I was just on my way to the privy."
"You have the eyes of a bitch in heat."
"What a terrible thing to say, Uncle."
"I'm sorry, child. Don't you see that I love you very much, and I'm worried about you? I can't allow you to ruin your life. Rose and I have worked out an excellent plan. Would you like to go to England? I can arrange for the two of you to sail within the month. That will give you time to buy what you need for the voyage."
England?
You will travel in first class, like queens, and once in London you will stay in a charming hotel a few blocks from Buckingham Palace.
Eliza understood that her uncle and aunt had arranged her future. The last thing she wanted was to go off in the opposite direction from Joaquin, putting two oceans between them.
Thank you, Uncle. I would love to know England, she said with all the sweetness she could muster.
The captain poured himself one brandy after another, lighted his pipe, and spent two solid hours telling Eliza about the advantages of life in London, where a young lady like her could mix in the best society, go to balls, attend the theater and concerts, buy beautiful dresses, and make a good marriage. She was at an age to do that. And wouldn't she like to go to Paris and Italy, too? No one should die without seeing Venice and Florence. He would personally see that she got everything she wanted. Hadn't he always done that? The world is filled with handsome, interesting men of good standing. She would find that out for herself as soon as she got out of the godforsaken port she was buried in. Valparaiso was no place for a girl as pretty and well-educated as she. It wasn't her fault that she fell in love with the first male to cross her path. She had been locked up all her life. And about that boy, what was his name? Someone who worked for Jeremy, wasn't he? She would soon forget him. Love, he assured her, inexorably burns itself out, or, with distance, is pulled up by the roots. No one could give her better advice than he could. Whatever else, he was an expert on distance, and love turned to ash.
I do not know what you're talking about, Uncle. Based on one glass of orange juice, Miss Rose has invented a novel about my being in love. This person came to deliver some crates. I offered him some juice. He took it, and then he left. That's all. Nothing happened, and I have never seen him again.
If it is, as you say, you are fortunate. That's one fantasy you won't have to eradicate.
John Summers continued drinking and talking till early dawn, while Eliza, curled up in the English leather chair, fell asleep, thinking that her prayers had been heard in heaven after all. It wasn't a timely earthquake that had saved her from Mama Frisia's terrible ministrations, but her uncle. In the hut in the patio, the Indian waited the whole night long. The Farewell. Saturday afternoon, John Summers invited his sister Rose to visit the ship owned by the Rodriguez de Santa Cruz. If everything worked out in the current negotiations, he would be captaining it, at last fulfilling his dream of sailing with steam. Later, Paulina received them in the salon of the Hotel Inglés, where she was staying. She had traveled from the north to set the ball rolling on her project, seeing that her husband had been in California for several months. They took advantage of the constant stream of ships coming and going to communicate via a vigorous correspondence, in which declarations of love were interwoven with business plans. Paulina had incorporated John Summers into their enterprise solely on intuition. She remembered vaguely that he was the brother of Jeremy and Rose Summers, some people from the English colony her father had invited to the hacienda once or twice. But she had seen him only once, and hadn't exchanged more than a few courteous words with him. Their one connection was their shared friendship with Jacob Todd, but in recent weeks she had made inquiries and was very satisfied with what she had heard. The captain had a solid reputation among seafaring men and in commercial accounting offices. He was a man whose experience and word could be trusted, which was more than you could say for many in these mad times, when anyone could rent a ship, form a company of adventurers, and set sail. In general, they were flimflam men, and their ships were lucky to stay afloat. But that mattered little or not at all, since as soon as they reached California, the associations evaporated, the ships were abandoned, and everyone shot off in search of gold. Paulina, however, had a long-term vision. To begin with, she was not obliged to respect the whims of strangers, because her only partners were her husband and her brother-in-law, and besides, the major part of the capital was hers, so she was free to make her own decisions. Her ship, which she christened the Fortuna, even though rather small and a veteran of 7 years at sea, was in impeccable condition. Paulina was prepared to pay the crew well to keep them from deserting to the gold frenzy, but she also assumed that without the iron hand of a good captain, no salary was big enough to maintain discipline on board. It was her husband and brother-in-law's plan to export mining tools, lumber, work clothing, domestic utensils, dried beef, grains, beans, and other non-perishable produce. But as soon as she set foot in Valparaíso, she realized that this plan had occurred to a number of others, and the competition would be ferocious. She took a good look around and saw the riot of vegetables and fruits of that generous summer. There was more than could be sold. Vegetables were growing in every patio, and trees were bowed beneath the weight of their fruit. Few people were inclined to pay for what they could have for free. She thought about her father's estate, where summer's bounty rotted on the ground because no one had enough interest to pick it up. If they could get it to California, it would be more valuable than gold itself, she thought. Fresh produce, Chilean wine, medicines, eggs, good clothing, musical instruments, and, why not, theater extravaganzas, operettas, music hall performances. Hundreds of immigrants were streaming into San Francisco every day. For the moment, they were mainly adventurers and outlaws, but soon settlers would be coming from the other side of the United States. Honest farmers, lawyers, doctors, teachers, all kinds of decent people ready to build a life with their families. Where there are women, there is civilization, and when that time comes in San Francisco, my ship will be there with all the necessities, she decided. Paulina received Captain John Summers and his sister Rose at tea time, when the heat of midday was waning and a fresh breeze was blowing from the sea. She was overdressed in comparison with the sober port society, head to toe butter-colored mousseline and lace, with a cluster of curls over each ear, and more jewelry than was acceptable at that hour of the day. Her 2-year-old son was kicking in the arms of a uniformed nursemaid, and a woolly little dog at her feet gobbled the bits of cake she placed in its mouth. The first half hour was taken up with introductions, drinking tea, and remembering Jacob Todd. "What has become of our good friend?" inquired Paulina, who would never forget the eccentric Englishman's intervention in her love affair with Feliciano.
"I haven't heard anything from him in some time," the captain informed her. "He went to England with me a couple of years ago. He was terribly depressed, but the sea air did him good, and by the time he got off the ship, he had recovered his good humor. The last I knew, he was thinking of forming a utopian colony."
"A what?" Paulina and Miss Rose exclaimed in unison.
"A group to live outside society with their own laws and government, guided by principles of equality, free love, and communal labor, as I remember. At least that was how he explained it 1,000 times during the voyage."
"He is even madder than we thought," Miss Rose concluded, feeling a touch of sadness for her loyal suitor.
"People with original ideas always end up being considered mad," Paulina noted. "Now, to come to the point, I have an idea I would like to discuss with you, Captain Summers. You know the Fortuna. How long would it take to steam between Valparaíso and the Golfo de Peñas?"
"Golfo de Peñas, but that's to the south, and it's not called the Gulf of Sorrows for nothing."
"Yes, it's farther south than Puerto Aysén."
"And what will I do there? There's nothing but islands, forest, and rain, Signora."
"Do you know these waters?"
"Yes, but I thought we were talking about going to San Francisco."
"Try these little pastries. They are delicious," she offered, petting the dog.
While John and Rose Summers were talking with Paulina in the salon of the Hotel Inglés, Eliza was roaming through El Almendral with Mama Frisia. It was near the time when students and guests were beginning to gather for the academy dancing class, and, most untypically, Miss Rose had let Eliza go for a couple of hours with her Nana as chaperone. Usually she did not let her protégé go near the academy without her. But the dancing master did not serve alcoholic beverages until after sunset, which kept the more troublesome youths away during the early evening. Eliza decided to seize the unique opportunity of getting out of the house without Miss Rose and convinced Mama Frisia to help her in her plans.
"Give me your blessing, Mamita," she asked. "I have to go to California to look for Joaquin."
"How can you do that alone and pregnant?" Mama Frisia exclaimed with horror. "If you don't help me, I'll do it alone. I am going to tell Miss Rose everything. If you do, I'll kill myself, and then I will come and haunt you for the rest of your days. I swear I will," the girl returned with fierce determination. The day before, she had seen a group of women in the port negotiating for a ticket. Because they looked so different from the women she normally saw in the street, heads covered winter or summer beneath their black mantles, she assumed these were the girls her Uncle John partied with.
"They are worse than dogs, Nina. They go to bed for money, and they have their big toes in hell," Mama Frisia had told her once.
Eliza had overheard some things the captain told Jeremy Summers about the Chilean and Peruvian women on their way to California, with plans to relieve the miners of their gold, but she couldn't imagine how they were going to do that. If those women could make the voyage alone and survive without help, she could do it too, she resolved. She walked quickly, her heart thudding and her face half hidden behind her fan, sweating in the December heat. She had brought her little velvet bag with the jewels of her trousseau. Her new ankle boots were acute torture, and her corset squeezed her waist. The stench of the open sewers that drained all the city's waste increased her nausea, but she walked erect, as she had learned in years of balancing a book on her head and of playing the piano with a metal rod strapped to her back. Mama Frisia, moaning and muttering prayers in her tongue, and slowed by varicose veins and her pounds, could barely keep up with her.
"Where are we going, child? Por Dios."
But Eliza couldn't answer because she didn't know. She was sure of one thing. There was no question of pawning her jewels and buying a ticket to California, because there was no way to do it without her Uncle John learning. Even though dozens of ships came and went every day, Valparaiso was a small city, and everyone in the port knew Captain John Summers. She had no identification papers and no chance at all of obtaining a passport, because the United States legation in Chile had been closed due to a frustrated love affair between some North American diplomat and a Chilean lady. Eliza concluded that the only way she could follow Joaquin Ondieta to California would be to stow away. Her Uncle John had told her that sometimes voyagers were sneaked onto a ship with the help of a crew member. Sometimes they managed to stay hidden the whole trip. Other times they died and their bodies went into the sea without anyone's ever knowing. But if they were discovered, both the stowaway and the ones who had helped him were punished. That was one of the times, he said, when he exercised his unquestionable authority as captain with the greatest rigor. On the high seas, there was no law or justice but his. Most of the illegal transactions in the port, according to her uncle, were carried out in the bars. Eliza had never been inside such a place, but when she saw a female figure heading for a nearby doorway, she recognized her as one of the women who had been on the dock the day before, looking for a way to get on one of the ships. She looked very young. She was short, broad-hipped, full-busted, had two black braids down her back, and was wearing a cotton skirt, embroidered blouse, and a shawl around her shoulders. Without a second thought, Eliza followed her, while Mama Frisia stood in the street voicing her warnings.
"No one goes in there but bad women, Nina. It's a mortal sin."
Eliza pushed the door open and took several seconds to adjust to the darkness and the blast of tobacco and rancid beer that struck her in the face. The place was crowded with men, and all eyes turned to look at the two women. For an instant, there was an expectant silence, followed immediately by a chorus of whistles and vulgarities. The other woman, a veteran of these scenes, marched toward a table at the rear of the room, slapping away right and left at hands trying to touch her. But Eliza stepped back blindly, horrified, not really understanding what was happening or why those men were shouting at her. As she backed toward the door, she crashed into a customer coming in. This individual grunted something in another language and caught her when she slipped. He was shocked when he saw who it was. Eliza, all virginal dress and fan, was completely out of place. She in turn immediately recognized the Chinese cook her uncle had spoken to the day before.
"Dao Chen,"
she asked, grateful for her good memory. The man greeted her by joining his hands before his face and bowing over and over as the whistling continued from the bar. Two sailors got to their feet and stumbled toward them. Dao Chen pointed toward the door and they both left.
"Miss Summers?"
he asked once they were outside. She nodded, but had no opportunity to say more, because they were interrupted by the two sailors from the bar who loomed in the doorway, pretty clearly drunk and looking for trouble.
"You dare to bother this pretty little lady, you stinking chink," they threatened.
Dao Chen ducked his head, half-turned, and made a move to leave, but one of the men stopped him short by grabbing his braid and tugging on it, while his buddy exhaled his whiny breath in Eliza's face, mumbling propositions. Dao Chen turned with the reflexes of a cat and faced the aggressor. His outsized knife was in his hand, the blade gleaming like a mirror in the summer sun. Mama Frisia grunted and, without even thinking, shouldered the nearest sailor like a plow horse, grabbed Eliza's arm, and raced off down the street with an agility unsuspected in any one of her pounds. The two women ran several blocks, putting distance between them and the red light district, not stopping until they reached San Agustin Plaza, where Mama Frisia collapsed, trembling, onto the first bench in sight.
Ay, niña, if my patrona ever finds out, she will kill me. Let's go straight home.
I haven't done what I came to do, mamita. I have to go back to that bar. Mama Frisia crossed her arms stoutly, refusing to budge, while Eliza strode back and forth, trying to organize a plan in the midst of her confusion. There wasn't much time. Miss Rose's instructions had been very clear. At exactly 6 o'clock, the coach would be in front of the dance academy to take them back home. She had to act quickly. She knew she would not have a second chance. This was their standoff when Eliza saw Dao Chen walking serenely in their direction, with his hesitant step and imperturbable smile. He repeated the usual ritual of his greeting, and then spoke to Eliza in good English to ask whether the honorable daughter of Captain John Summers needed assistance. Eliza clarified that she was Summers' niece, not his daughter, and with a rush of sudden confidence or desperation, confessed that, in fact, she did need his help, but that it was an extremely private matter.
Something the captain cannot know. No one can know.
Dao Chen begged her pardon. The captain was a good man, he said. It was true that his employer had been underhanded when he shanghaied him for his crew, but he had treated him well, and Dao could not think of betraying him. Crushed, Eliza sank down on the bench with her face in her hands, while Mama Frisia watched them, not understanding a word of their English, but guessing the drift. Finally, she leaned over to Eliza and tugged a few times on the velvet pouch that held the jewels.
"Do you think that anyone does anything for free in this world, Nina?" she asked.
Eliza got the point. She dried her tears and, indicating a place beside her on the bench, invited the man to sit down. She dug into the pouch and pulled out the pearl necklace her Uncle John had given her the day before and laid it on Dao Chen's knees.
"Can you hide me in a ship? I have to go to California," she explained.
"Why, that's no place for women, only bandits."
"I'm looking for something."
"Gold?"
"Something more valuable than gold."
The man stared open-mouthed because he had never seen a woman capable of such extremes in real life, only in classic novels in which the heroines always died at the end.
"With this necklace, you can buy your passage. You don't have to hide," said Dao Chen, who was not inclined to complicate his life by breaking the law.
"No captain will take me without notifying my family."
Dao Chen's initial surprise turned into frank amazement. This woman was actually planning to dishonor her family and was expecting him to help her. A devil had gotten into her body, no doubt of it. Again, Eliza reached into the pouch. She took out a gold brooch set with turquoises and set it beside the necklace.
"Have you ever loved anyone more than life itself, Signor?" she asked.
Dao Chen looked into the girl's eyes for the first time since they had met, and he must have seen something in them because he picked up the necklace and hid it beneath his shirt, then handed the brooch back to Eliza. He stood up, adjusted his cotton pants and the butcher knife in his sash, and again bowed ceremoniously.
"I no longer work for Captain Summers. Tomorrow the brigantine Amelia sails for California. Come tonight at 10, and I will get you on board."
"How?"
"I do not know. We shall see."
Dao Chen proffered another courteous farewell and walked away so silently and quickly that he seemed to have vanished like smoke. Eliza and Mama Frisia arrived at the dance academy just in time to meet the coachman, who had killed a half-hour wait while drinking from his flask. The Amelia was a ship of French registry, once svelte and swift, but she had plowed through many seas and centuries before had lost the impetus of youth. She was crisscrossed with ancient marine scars,
She carried a crust of mollusks on her matronly hips. Her exhausted joints moaned in the pounding seas, and her stained and repatched sail looked like a petticoat ready for the rag bag. She sailed from Valparaiso on the radiant morning of February 18, 1849, carrying 87 passengers of the male sex, 5 women, 6 cows, 8 hogs, 3 cats, 18 sailors, a Dutch captain, a Chilean pilot, and a Chinese cook. Eliza was also aboard, but the only person who knew of her existence was Dao Qian. The first-class passengers were crowded into staterooms on the forward deck, without much privacy, but considerably more comfortable than those in tiny cabins with 4 bunks each, or out on the open deck after casting lots to see where to stow their bundles. One cabin below the waterline was assigned to the 5 Chilean women who were off to test their luck in California. In the port of Cayá, 2 Peruvians came aboard and were unceremoniously shoved in with them, 2 to a bunk. Captain Vincent Katz instructed his crew, as well as the passengers, that they were not to have the least social contact with the females, for he was not about to allow indecent congress on his ship, and in his eyes it was obvious that those women were not the most virtuous, although, inevitably, his orders were violated over and over during the voyage. The men greatly missed female companionship, and the humble bawds off on an adventure hadn't a peso in their pockets. The cows and hogs, well secured in small pens on the second deck, were to provide fresh milk and meat for the passengers, whose diet would consist primarily of beans, hardtack, salted meat, and whatever fish they could catch. To compensate for such monotony, the more affluent passengers brought some of their own provisions, especially wine and cigars, but most on board endured their hunger. 2 of the cats were set loose to hold down the rats, which otherwise would have reproduced uncontrollably during the 2 months of the voyage. The 3rd traveled with Eliza. The belly of the Amelia held the assorted luggage of the passengers and cargo destined for the California trade, organized in such a way as to obtain maximum usage of the limited space. Nothing would be touched until the final destination, and no one went there except the cook, the one person with authorized access to the strictly rationed dried staples. Dao Qian kept the keys at his waist and personally answered to the captain for the contents of the storerooms. There, in the darkest, deepest pit of the ship, in a 2-by-2-meter hole, went Eliza. The walls and ceiling of her cavern were trunks and cases of merchandise. Her bed was a sack, and the only light came from a candle stub. She had a soup bowl for food, a jug for water, and a bucket for her physical needs. She could take a couple of steps and stretch among the bales and crates, and could cry and scream as much as she wished, because the sloshing of the waves against the ship swallowed her voice. Her one contact with the outside world was Dao Qian, who invented a variety of pretexts to come down to feed her and empty her bucket. Her only company was the cat, closed in the hold to control the rats. But during the terrible weeks of the sailing, the unfortunate animal slowly went crazy, and finally, sadly, Dao Qian cut its throat with his knife. Eliza was taken aboard in a sack over the back of a stevedore, one of many loading cargo and luggage in Valparaiso. She never learned how Dao Qian had managed to win the man's complicity and evade the vigilance of the captain and the pilot, who entered in a log everything that came onto the ship. She had escaped a few hours earlier thanks to a complicated scheme that involved a fake written invitation from the Del Valle family to come visit for a few days at their hacienda. It was not an outlandish subterfuge. On previous occasions, the daughters of Augustin Del Valle had invited her to the country, and Miss Rose had allowed her to go, always accompanied by Mama Frisia. She said goodbye to Jeremy, Miss Rose, and her Uncle John with false lightheartedness, feeling a weight like a stone in her chest. She saw them sitting at the breakfast table, reading English newspapers, completely innocent of her plans, and an overwhelming indecision nearly caused her to stay. They represented security and well-being. They were her only family. But she had crossed the line of decency. There was no turning back. The summers had brought her up within the strict norms of good behavior, and such a serious slip sullied their good name. If she fled, the family reputation would be stained, but at least they would have the benefit of the doubt. They could always say she had died.
Whatever story the Summers offered the world, she wouldn't have to watch them suffer the shame. The odyssey of going to find her lover seemed to be her one possible course, but in that moment of silent farewell she was assaulted by such sadness that she came close to bursting into tears and confessing everything. Then the last image of Joaquin Andieta the night he had left materialized with startling precision to remind her of her debt to their love. She caught up some loose strands of her hair, set her Italian straw bonnet on her head, and left waving goodbye. She took with her the suitcase Miss Rose had packed with her best summer dresses, a little money she had taken from Jeremy Summers' room, and the jewels of her trousseau. She had been tempted to take Miss Rose's as well, but at the last moment was stayed by her respect for the woman who had been a mother to her. In her own room, in the empty coffer, she left a brief letter thanking them for all they had done for her and reiterating how much she loved them. She added a confession about the things she had taken to protect the servants from being accused. Mama Frisia had put her stoutest boots in the suitcase, along with her notebooks and the bundle of Joaquin Andieta's love letters. She also took a heavy Castile woolen mantle, a gift from her Uncle John. They left without arousing the least suspicion. The coachman left them in the street of the Del Valle home and drove out of view without waiting for the gate to be opened. Mama Frisia and Eliza set off toward the port to meet Dao Chen at the place and the time they had agreed upon. He was waiting for them. He took the suitcase from Mama Frisia's hands and motioned to Eliza to follow him. The girl and her Nana embraced for a long time. They knew they would never see each other again, but neither shed tears.
"What are you going to tell Miss Rose, Mamacita?"
"Nothing. I am leaving right now to go to my people in the south. No one will ever find me."
"Thank you, Mamita. I will never forget you.
And I am going to pray that everything goes well with you, Nina."
Were the last words Eliza heard from Mama Frisia's lips before she followed the Chinese cook into a fisherman's hut. In the dark, windowless wood shack reeking of fish, its only ventilation the door, Dao Chen handed Eliza a pair of baggy trousers and a worn smock, indicating that she should put them on. He made no move to go outside or discreetly turn away. Eliza hesitated. She had never removed her clothes before a man, except Joaquin Andieta. But Dao Chen, who lacked a sense of privacy, failed to perceive her confusion. The body and its functions were natural to him, and he considered modesty more inconvenient than virtuous. Eliza realized that this was not the time for scruples. The ship was leaving that morning, and the last dinghies were loading on the stragglers' luggage. She removed her straw bonnet, undid the buttons on her kidskin boots and her dress, untied the strings of her petticoats, and, nearly swooning with shame, gestured to Dao Chen to help her undo her corset. As the articles of a young English lady's clothing piled up on the floor one by one, she was losing contact with known reality and irreversibly entering the strange illusion that would be her life in the months to come. She had the clear sensation of beginning a new story in which she was both protagonist and narrator. Fourth Son. Dao Chen had not always had that name. In fact, he had no name until he was 11. His parents were too poor to worry about details. He was simply called Fourth Son. He was born 9 years before Eliza in a village in the province of Kuangtung, a day and a half's walk from the city of Canton. He came from a family of healers. For countless generations, the men of his blood had passed from father to son their knowledge of medicinal plants, the art of drawing off bad humors, magic for frightening away demons, and skills for regulating energy, ki. The year Fourth Son was born, the family found itself in worse poverty than ever, and for some time they had been losing their land to moneylenders and gamblers. The officials of the empire collected taxes, kept the money, then imposed new tributes to cover up what they had stolen, and for good measure demanded illegal commissions and bribes. Fourth Son's family, like most of the peasants, could not pay. If they managed to save a few coins of their meager income from the mandarins, they immediately lost them gambling, one of the few diversions available to the poor. They could bet on frog and grasshopper races, cockroach fights, or fantan, along with many other popular games. Fourth Son was a happy child who laughed over nothing, but he also had an unusual ability to concentrate and a keen curiosity for learning. By the time he was 7, he knew that the talent of a good healer consists of maintaining the balance between yin and yang. At 9, he knew the properties of the regional plants and could help his father and older brothers in the tiresome preparation of the plasters, salves, tonics, balms, syrups, powders, and pills of the peasant pharmacopoeia. First Son and his father traveled by foot from village to village, offering treatments and remedies, while Second Son and Third Son cultivated the wretched piece of land that was the family's only capital. Fourth Son had the mission of collecting plants, and he liked doing that because it allowed him to wander outside the village unsupervised, inventing games and imitating the songbirds. Sometimes, if she had enough strength after her endless household chores, his mother went with him. Because she was a woman, she could not work the land without drawing the derision of the neighbors. The family scratched to make ends meet, falling deeper and deeper into debt, until the fateful year of 1834, when their worst demons descended with full fury. First, a pot of boiling water overturned on the youngest sister, barely 2, scalding her from head to foot. They applied egg white to the burns and treated her with the herbs indicated in such injuries, but in less than 3 days the child died, exhausted from suffering. The mother never recovered. She had lost other sons and daughters in infancy. Each had left a bleeding wound, and the little girl's accident was like the grain of rice that makes the bowl overflow. She began to decline before their eyes, thinner every day, her skin greenish, her bones brittle, and all her husband's bruise could not stay the implacable advance of her mysterious illness, until the morning they found her, rigid, a smile of relief on her lips, and her eyes at peace because at last she was going to meet the children she had lost. The funeral rites were very simple, because she was a woman and because they could not pay a monk. Neither did they have rice to offer relatives and neighbors during the ceremony, but at least they made sure that her spirit did not take refuge in the roof, the well, or the rats' nests, and later come out to haunt them. Without the one whose strength and patience had kept the family together through every trial, it was impossible to fend off calamity. It was a year of typhoons, bad harvests, and famine. The vast land of China was overrun with beggars and bandits. The one girl child left in the family, who was 7, was sold to an agent and never heard from again. First Son, destined to take his father's place in the calling of itinerant healer, was bitten by a rabid dog and died soon after, foaming at the mouth, his back arched like a bow. Second Son and Third Son were of an age to work, and to them fell the task of looking after their father in life, along with the future responsibilities of carrying out the funeral rites at his death and honoring his memory and that of their male ancestors for 5 generations. Fourth Son was of no particular value and was another mouth to feed, so his father sold him into 10 years of servitude to merchants whose caravan passed near their village. The boy was 11 years old. Thanks to one of those happy events that often changes the course of a life, that period of slavery, which could have been a hell for the boy, would turn out to be much better than the years he had spent under the paternal roof. 2 mules pulled the cart loaded with the heavy goods of the caravan. A nerve-wracking squeal accompanied every turn of the wheels, purposely left unoiled in order to frighten away demons. Fourth Son was tied with a rope to one of the animals to keep him from running away. Barefoot and thirsty, with his meager bundle of belongings on his back, he saw the roofs of his village and all the familiar landscape fade away behind him. He wept bitterly from the moment he left his father and brothers. Life in their little hut was the only life he had known, and it had not been unhappy. His parents had treated him gently, his mother had told him stories, and any excuse was cause to laugh and celebrate, even in times of the worst poverty. He trotted along behind the mule, convinced that every step was taking him deeper and deeper into the territory of evil spirits, and fearing that the squealing of the wheels and the little bells hanging from the cart would not be enough to protect him. He could barely understand the merchant's dialect, but the few words he could capture struck fear into his bones. They were talking about the many unhappy spirits roaming the region, lost souls of the dead who had not received a proper funeral. Famine, typhus, and cholera had strewn the landscape with corpses, and there were not enough living left to honor so many dead. Fortunately, ghosts and demons had a reputation for being a little slow. They didn't know how to turn a corner and were easily distracted with offerings of food or paper gifts. Sometimes, however, nothing could keep them away, and they might suddenly reappear, eager to earn their freedom by murdering strangers and inhabiting their bodies to make them carry out unthinkable deeds. The caravan had traveled for hours. The summer heat and the thirst were intense. The little boy tripped every two steps, and his impatient new masters urged him on by flicking his legs with a willow switch, though with no real malice. As the sun set, they decided to stop and make camp. They relieved the animals of their load, built a fire, brewed tea, and split into small groups to play fantan and mahjong. Finally, they remembered Fourth Son and handed him a bowl of rice and a glass of tea, which he attacked with the voraciousness of months of hunger. As they were eating, they were surprised by deafening yells and found themselves engulfed in a cloud of dust. The traveler's howls were added to those of the attackers, and the terrorized boy dragged himself beneath the cart as far as the rope he was tied by would allow. This was no legion from hell, he quickly realized, but a band of robbers, one of many that, flaunting defiance of bumbling imperial soldiers, afflicted the highways and byways in those hopeless times. As soon as the merchants recovered from their first shock, they seized their weapons and confronted the attackers amid a tumult of yells, threats, and shots that lasted but a few minutes. When the dust settled, one of the bandits had escaped, and two others were lying on the ground, gravely wounded. The merchants tore the cloth masks from their faces and revealed two ragged adolescents armed with clubs and crude spears. The brigands were decapitated with dispatch so that they would suffer the humiliation of leaving this world in pieces, not whole as they had come into it, and their heads were impaled on stakes on either side of the road. As the merchants were catching their breath, they found one member of the caravan writhing on the ground with a serious spear wound in the thigh. Fourth Son, who had been paralyzed with fear beneath the cart, came wriggling out of his hiding place and respectfully asked the honorable merchants if he could attend the wounded man. Since there was no alternative, they gave Fourth Son permission to proceed. He asked for tea to wash away the blood, then opened his pack and pulled out a bottle containing Bai Yao. He rubbed the white salve on the wound, wrapped the leg tightly, and proclaimed without hesitation that in fewer than 3 days the wound would have healed. And so it did. That incident saved Dao Chen from spending the next 10 years working like a slave and being treated worse than a dog. The merchants took notice of his skills and sold him in Canton to a famous traditional physician and acupuncture master, a Zhongyi, who needed an apprentice. With that wise man, Fourth Son acquired knowledge he would never have obtained from his rustic father. His aged master was a placid man, slow to speak, with a face as round as the moon, and bony, sensitive hands, his best instruments. The first thing he did with his servant was to give him a name. He consulted astrological and seer's books to find the name that corresponded to the boy, Dao. The word had several meanings, among them way, direction, sense, and harmony, but especially it represented the journey of life. The master gave Dao his own family name.
You will be called Dao Chen. That name will start you on the road of medicine. Your destiny will be to ease pain and achieve wisdom. You will be a Zhongyi like me. Dao Chen, the young apprentice, received his name gratefully. He kissed his master's hands and smiled for the first time since he had left his home.
The impulse of joy that once had made him dance with happiness for no reason at all beat again in his chest, and his smile did not fade for weeks. He skipped around the house, savoring his name like a sweet in his mouth, repeating it aloud and dreaming of it until he was fully identified with it. His master, a follower of Confucius in practical matters and of Buddha in ideology, taught him with a firm hand, but with great gentleness, the discipline that led to making him a good physician.
If I succeed in teaching you everything I mean to, some day you will be an enlightened man, he told him.
He maintained that rites and ceremonies were as necessary as the norms of good behavior and respect for hierarchies. He said that knowledge was of little use without wisdom, and that there was no wisdom without spirituality, and that true spirituality always included service to others. As he explained many times, the essence of a good physician consisted of a capacity for compassion and a sense of the ethical, without which qualities the sacred art of healing degenerated into simple charlatanism. He liked the ready smile of his apprentice.
You have already traveled a good distance along the path of wisdom, Dao. The wise man is always joyful, he maintained.
Throughout the year, Dao Qian got out of bed at dawn, like any student, to do his hour of meditation, chants, and prayers. He had one day of rest on which to celebrate the new year. Working and studying were his only occupations. Before anything else, he had to learn Chinese script to perfection. It was the official medium of communication in that enormous land of hundreds of peoples and languages. His master was inflexible in regard to the beauty and precision of calligraphy, which distinguishes the refined man from the scoundrel. He also insisted on developing in Dao Qian the artistic sensitivity which, according to him, characterized the superior being. Like all civilized Chinese, he had an immeasurable aversion to war, and was, in contrast, inclined toward the arts of music, painting, and literature. By his side, Dao Qian learned to appreciate the delicate lace of a spider web, pearled with dewdrops in the light of dawn, and to express his pleasure in inspired poems written in elegant calligraphy. In the opinion of the master, the only thing worse than not writing poetry was writing it badly. In his master's house, the boy attended the frequent reunions in which the guests admired the garden and created verses in the impulse of the instant, while he served tea and listened, enthralled. One could win immortality by writing a book, especially a book of poems, said the master, who had written several. To the homespun practical knowledge he had acquired by watching his father at work, Dao Qian added the impressive theoretical volume of ancestral Chinese medicine. The youth learned that the human body is composed of five elements, wood, fire, earth, metal, and water, and that those elements are associated with five planets, five atmospheric conditions, five colors, and five notes. Through the proper use of medicinal plants, acupuncture, and cupping glasses, a good physician could prevent and cure various maladies and control masculine energy, active and light, and feminine energy, passive and dark, yin and yang. The goal of this art, however, was not so much to eliminate illness as to maintain harmony. You must choose your food, orient your bed, and conduct your meditation according to the season of the year and the direction of the wind. In that way, you will always resonate with the universe, the master counseled. The Zhongyi was content with his fate, although the lack of descendants weighed like a shadow over his serenity of spirit. He had never had sons, despite the miraculous herbs regularly ingested during an entire lifetime to cleanse his blood and fortify his member, and the remedies and spells applied to two wives, both dead in their youth, as well as the many concubines who followed. He had to accept with humility that it had not been the fault of those self-denying women, but the apathy of his virile liquors. None of the remedies for fertility he had used to help others aided him, and finally he became resigned to the irrefutable fact that his loins were barren. He stopped punishing his wives with fruitless demands and enjoyed them to the full, in accord with the precepts of the beautiful pillow books in his collection. However, the aged physician, far more interested in acquiring new knowledge and exploring the narrow path of wisdom, had long ago, one by one, shed the concubines whose presence distracted him from his intellectual pursuits. He did not have to have a young woman before his eyes in order to describe her in elegant poems. Memory was sufficient. He had also surrendered hope for sons of his own, but he needed to prepare for the future. Who would help him in the last stage of his life and at the hour of his death? Who would clean his tomb and venerate his memory? He had trained apprentices before, and with each had nourished the secret ambition of adopting him, but none was worthy of the honor. Dao Chen was no more intelligent or intuitive than the others, but he carried within him an obsession for learning that the master immediately recognized because it was identical to his own. He was, besides, a sweet and entertaining lad. It was easy to become fond of him. In the years they lived together, he gained such an appreciation of Dao that often he asked himself how it was possible that he was not a child of his blood. Nevertheless, esteem for his apprentice did not blind him. In his experience, the changes of adolescence may be very profound, and he could not predict what kind of man Dao would make. As the Chinese proverb says, brilliance in youth does not guarantee worth in maturity. He feared he would be mistaken, as he had been before, and he preferred to wait patiently for the true nature of the boy to be revealed. In the meanwhile, he guided him, as he did the young trees in his garden, to help him grow straight. At least this one learns quickly, the aged physician thought, calculating how many years he had left to live. According to the astral signs and careful observation of his body, he would not have time to train a new apprentice. Soon Dao Qian learned to select their supplies in the market and herb shops. Watching the physician as he worked, he came to know the intricate mechanisms of the human body, procedures for cooling fevers and fiery temperaments, for giving warmth to those who suffered the cold of approaching death, for stirring the juices in sterile men, and for stopping the flux of watery bowels. He made long trips through the fields to look for the best plants at the precise point of maximum efficacy, then wrapped them in damp rags to keep them fresh on his way back to the city. When he turned 14, his master considered him ready to practice and regularly sent him to attend prostitutes with the stringent order to abstain from any commerce with them because, as he himself would see when he examined them, death rode on their shoulders. Diseases of the brothels kill more people than opium and typhus. But if you carry out your obligations and learn at a good pace, in due time I will buy you a young virgin, his master promised. Dao Chen had suffered hunger as a boy, but his body stretched until he became taller than any other member of his family. At 14, he felt no attraction toward those girls for hire, merely scientific curiosity. They were too different from him. They lived in a world that was so remote and secret that he could not consider them truly human. Later, when the sudden onslaught of nature unhinged him and he was staggering around like a drunk tripping over his shadow, his teacher regretted having let his concubines go. Nothing so distracted a good student from his responsibilities as the explosion of virility. A woman would calm him and, in passing, be useful in giving him practical knowledge, but the idea of buying one was bothersome. The master was comfortable in his solely masculine universe, and he gave Dao herbal teas to calm his ardor. The Zhongyi did not remember the hurricane of carnal passions, and with the best intention gave his student the pillow books from his library to read as part of his education, not thinking to measure the debilitating effect they would have on his wretched pupil. He made Dao memorize each of the 222 positions of love, along with their poetic names, until he could identify them unhesitatingly in the exquisite illustrations of the books, all of which added immeasurably to the young man's distractions. Dao Chen became as familiar with Canton as once he had been with his small village. He liked that ancient, chaotic walled city of twisting streets and canals, where palaces and huts were jumbled together indiscriminately, and there were people who lived and died on boats on the river without ever stepping onto dry land. He grew used to the humid, hot climate of a long summer lashed with typhoons, but pleasant in the winter months of October to March. Canton was sealed to foreigners, although from time to time pirates flying flags of other nations made a surprise raid. There were a few locations where, from November to May, Foreigners could trade their merchandise, but there were so many taxes, regulations, and obstacles that most international merchants chose to set up business in Macau. Early in the morning, when Dao Chen was on his way to the market, it was not unusual to find newborn baby girls thrown like garbage into the street or floating in the canals, often chewed on by dogs or rats. No one wanted them. They were disposable. Why feed a daughter who had no value and was going to end up as a servant in the home of her future husband? Better a deformed son than a dozen girls as wise as Buddha, was the popular saying. There were too many children anyway. Brothels and opium dens proliferated on all sides. Canton was a populous city, rich and light-hearted, filled with temples, restaurants, and gaming houses, where all the festivals of the calendar were noisily observed. Even punishments and executions became a cause for a celebration. Great crowds gathered to cheer on the executioners with their bloody aprons and collections of sharp knives that could lop off a head with a single sure-handed blow. Justice was meted out promptly and simply, with no appeal or unnecessary cruelty, except in the case of betrayal of the emperor, the worst possible crime, which was paid for with slow death and the banishment of all relatives, thereby reduced to slavery. Minor crimes were punished by lashing, or by placing the guilty party's head in a wood stock for several days, so that he could not rest or reach his head with his hands to eat or scratch. Squares and markets were home to the popular storytellers who, like mendicant monks, traveled about the country preserving a centuries-old oral tradition. Jugglers, acrobats, snake charmers, transvestites, traveling musicians, magicians, and contortionists performed in the streets, while all around them seethed a commerce in silk, tea, jade, spices, gold, tortoiseshell, porcelain, ivory, and precious stones. Vegetables, fruits, and meats were offered in colorful profusion. Cabbages and tender bamboo shoots were displayed beside cages of the cats, dogs, and raccoons that, at a client's request, the butcher killed and skinned in one maneuver. There were long alleys where only birds were sold, for no one was ever without birds, and their cages, from the simplest to those made of the finest woods inlaid with silver and mother-of-pearl. Other passageways in the market were devoted to exotic fish, which were known to attract good fortune. Dao Chen, always curious, would entertain himself looking at everything and making friends, and then he would run to complete his errands in the sector where the supplies for his vocation were sold. He could identify it blindfolded from the penetrating scent of spices, plants, and medicinal barks. Dried serpents were rolled up and set in heaps like dusty coils of rope. Toads, salamanders, and strange marine creatures were strung on cords like beads. Crickets and large beetles with hard, phosphorescent shells languished in boxes. Monkeys of all kinds awaited their turn to die. Bear and orangutan paws, antelope and rhinoceros horns, tiger eyes, shark fins, and claws of mysterious nocturnal birds were sold by weight. Dao Chen's first years in Canton were spent in study, work, and service to his aged mentor, whom he came to respect like a grandfather. Those were happy years. The memory of his own family faded, and he forgot the faces of his father and his brothers, but not his mother's, because she appeared to him frequently. Study soon ceased to be a task and became a passion. Every time he learned something new, he flew to his master to blurt it out to him. "The more you learn, the sooner you will know how little you know," the ancient would say, laughing. On his own initiative, Dao Chen decided to learn Mandarin and Cantonese, because the dialect of his village seemed very limited. He absorbed the knowledge of his master so swiftly that the old man jokingly accused him of stealing even his dreams. But his passion for teaching made him generous. He shared with the boy everything he wanted to investigate, not only in matters of medicine, but other aspects of his vast reserve of knowledge and refined culture. Magnanimous by nature, he was nonetheless severe in his criticism and demanding of effort, because, as he said, "I do not have much time left, and I cannot take all I know to the other world. Someone must use it upon my death." However, he also warned his pupil against greed for learning, for that could fetter a man as surely as gluttony or lust,
The wise man desires nothing. He does not judge. He makes no plans. He keeps his mind open and his heart at peace, he maintained.
He reprimanded Dao Qian with such sadness when the youth failed that he would have preferred a lashing, but that practice went against the nature of the Zhongyi, who never allowed anger to determine his actions. The only occasions on which he ceremoniously punished Dao Qian with a willow switch, without anger but with firm didactic purpose, was when he could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that his apprentice had yielded to the temptation of gambling or had paid for a woman. Dao Qian used to juggle the market bills in order to make bets in the gaming houses, whose attraction he could not resist, or for a brief student-rate consolation in the arms of one of his patients in the brothels. It never took the master long to discover these offenses, because if Dao lost in gambling, he could not explain what had happened to the change, and if he won, he was incapable of hiding his euphoria. As for women, his master could smell them on his skin.
Take off your shirt. I will have to apply the bamboo and see if finally you understand, my son. How many times have I told you that the worst evils in China are gambling and brothels? In the former, men lose the product of their labors, and in the latter, they lose their health and life. You will never be a good physician or a good poet if you have those vices.
In 1839, when the Opium War between China and Great Britain broke out, Dao Qian was 16 years old. At that point, the country was overrun with beggars. Masses of humanity poured from the countryside and appeared with their tatters and pustules in the cities, where they were driven back, forced to wander the highways of the empire like packs of starving dogs. Bands of robbers and rebels fought an endless war of ambushes against the government troops. It was a period of destruction and pillage. The weakened imperial armies, under the command of corrupt officers receiving contradictory orders from Peking, could do nothing against the powerful and well-disciplined English fleet. They could not draw upon popular support because the peasants were so weary of seeing their paddies destroyed, their villages in flames, and their daughters raped by soldiers. At the end of almost 4 years of struggle, China had to accept a humiliating defeat and pay the equivalent of $21 million to their British conquerors, yield Hong Kong to them, and grant them the right to establish concessions, residential enclaves protected by extraterritorial laws. There, the foreigners lived with their own police, services, and government and laws, guarded by their own troops. The concessions were true foreign nations inside Chinese territory, from which the Europeans controlled trade, principally opium. They did not enter Canton until 5 years later, but after the acupuncture master witnessed the degrading defeat of his venerated emperor and saw the economy and morale of his nation sag, he decided there was no reason to go on living. During the war years, the aged Zhong Yi's spirit visibly deteriorated, and he lost the serenity so arduously won over the course of his lifetime. His withdrawal and inattention to material matters reached such a point that after his master had eaten nothing for days, Dao Qian had to spoon food into his mouth. The accounts became hopelessly entangled, and creditors began to beat at the door. But his master dismissed them, for anything having to do with money seemed a repugnant burden from which sages were naturally immune. In the senile confusion of his last years, Dao's teacher forgot his good intentions in regard to adopting his apprentice and providing him with a wife. In truth, his mind was so cloudy that he often sat staring at Dao Qian with a perplexed expression, unable to remember his name or to place him in the labyrinth of faces and events that assailed him without order or harmony. But he had enough spirit still to direct the details of his burial, because for enlightened Chinese, the most important event in life was one's funeral. The idea of putting an end to his depressing life by means of an elegant death had been with him for some time, but he awaited the outcome of the war with the secret and irrational hope of seeing the triumph of the armies of the Celestial Empire. The foreigner's arrogance was intolerable. He felt a great scorn for those brutal Fan Wei, white ghosts who seldom washed, who drank milk and alcohol, and who were ignorant of the elementary norms of good behavior and incapable of honoring their ancestors as custom demanded. To him, the commercial accord seemed a favor the emperor had granted the ingrate barbarians, who, instead of bowing before him with praise and gratitude, kept demanding more. When the Treaty of Nanking was signed, it was the final blow for the Zhongyi. The emperor and every citizen of China, down to the most humble, was dishonored. How could one recover his dignity following such an affront? The ancient sage poisoned himself by swallowing gold. When his disciple returned from one of his excursions into the country to gather plants, he found the Zhongyi in the garden, lying on silk cushions and dressed in white as a sign of mourning for himself. By his side, his tea was still warm and the ink from his brush still fresh. On his small desk was an unfinished poem, and a dragonfly cast a shadow upon the smooth parchment. Dao Qian kissed the hands of this man who had given him so much, then paused in the crepuscular light for an instant to appreciate the tracery of the dragonfly's transparent wings, just as his master would have wished him to do.